NBA on NBC.
What is up, everybody? This is Jim Mylock, and you're listening to Pot of Fame, the podcast where we break down the careers of former athletes and decide whether or not they should get a call to the Hall. On today's Pot of Fame book club episode, we are talking about the book The Big Time, How the 1970s Transformed Sports in America by Michael McCambridge. And we are going to have Michael himself on the pod in just a second. Discuss this book that honestly changed the way I look at the 1970s. I mean, I was born at the end of 1989. I was not alive for any of the events that take place in this book, but I'm, you know, very well aware of them. You know, Hank Aaron breaking Babe Ruth's home run record, Dr. J in the ABA, Muhammad Ali's, you know, Thriller in Manila, The Rumble of the Jungle, Billie Jean King, Battle of Sexes. You got the Steelers and the NFL dominating. You got the Bronx Zoo in New York. There's a lot that happens in the 70s, but I feel like, you know, to be honest, the 70s, whenever I hear anyone talk about it, it's like nothing happened in the 70s. You know, the 80s were so much better. And again, as a child of the 90s, I love the 90s. So I knew all these events happened, but I've never really thought about how many things happened around the same time. And then you look at kind of bigger events too, like the breakthrough in women's sports, television just exploding. There was a lot that happened in the 70s. And as Michael's, you know, cover says here, transformed sports in America, you know, from the end of the 60s into the beginning of the 80s here, a lot happened in the 70s to really just launch sports into a different, I would say, stratosphere in the 1980s. And Michael's book covers so much more than just sports. It covers what was going on in the United States at the time, the world, and weaves sports in and out throughout. It's an excellent book. It's, you know, about 400 with the index at the back. It's about 500 pages, but 400 pages to read. I got through it really quickly because it's a fun read and it covers so much. And Michael and today, you know, Michael jumped on the pod. We had a blast talking about the book, talking about 70 sports, and me, of course, asking him kind of tough questions like, you know, who would be on 1970 sports Rushmore? What event would you want to be at yourself? And things of that nature. So Christmas and the holiday season in general is upon us. Listen to the pod, but I think this is a great stocking stuffer for anyone that grew up in the 70s, is a fan of sports in general, or just wants, honestly, a fun read and wants to learn about America in the 70s. This is for them. So with the quick facts out of the way, let's bring on Michael. All right, so I'd like to welcome to the podcast today, author Michael McCambridge. Michael, welcome to the podcast. How are you doing today on this glorious Friday? It's pretty sunny over here in Chicago.
It's raining in Austin, Texas, but happy Friday nonetheless.
Well, you know what? You can brag about your weather pretty much the rest of the winter while I suffer out here in Chicago. But Michael, you are here to talk about your latest book, The Big Time, How the 1970s Transformed Sports in America. This came out back in October. I just finished it up yesterday. I was like, I'm having you on today. I got to finish this. It's a, what, we're around a 500-page book? Give or take with all the notes at the
like 100 pages of end notes.
Okay, 400 pages then.
Yeah.
400-page book. But honestly, I'm sure you could have made this into a 700, 800-page book because so much happened in the 1970s. And something I have to compliment you on, you did such a good job of both diving pretty deep into some of the monumental moments, but also finding ways to throw in every little Easter egg you could, which for me is that, I mean, I love that stuff. I eat that stuff up. So again, the book came back out in October. It was about the 1970s and in sports, and honestly covered every sport in the 70s. Michael, my first question to you is kind of an easy one in the beginning here. Maybe it's not, but you know what? This is not your first book. You've written several books over the years. What led you to write this book? How did this book come to be?
There were a few factors. First of all, I should preface this by saying I think everybody who loves sports remembers the era in which they fell in love with sports as like the best era, the ideal era, the most colorful era, the most memorable era. That's just People who grew up with the 50s think it was the 50s. People who grew up in the 60s remember that. I grew up in the 70s. So that was when, you know, from the age of seven on, I was subscribing to Sports Illustrated and getting the sporting news and dragging my mom down to the big newsstand in downtown Kansas City to look for, you know, Pro Football Weekly or a new Street and Smith's basketball annual or what have you. So I had had my own experience of falling in love with sports in the 70s. And I enjoyed the Twitter account Super 70 Sports by the guy Ricky Cobb, this sort of profane but consistently funny takedown of a lot of things in the 70s. And, you know, he had all the people with the long hair and all the great bits. But the more I've learned about sports, the more I recognized that in addition to, it certainly was an era of long hair and low inhibitions, it was also a really decisive, pivotal decade in American sports. Now, every decade brings about change, but it was clear that by the end of the 70s, spectator sports occupied a different area, a different realm in the culture than it did at the beginning of the 70s. And so the reason I wanted to write this broad social history is to answer, how did that happen? Why did it happen? What happened to make it so? And I think the other thing that really convinced me that there was a book here was the reputation of the 70s in general. There was a historian who wrote a book about America in the 70s, and the title was, It Seemed Like Nothing Happened. You know, so the decade has this sort of cut-rate reputation, and yet within the realm of sports, it was, I believe, transformational. You have sports moving into primetime network television, thanks to the success of Monday Night Football in a way that it just hadn't before. You had athletes beginning to get a sense of their own autonomy through free agency. The dawn of the free agency era was in the 70s. You have integration becoming much more the rule than the exception within American sports, in a way that was ahead of the society as a whole. And finally, you have women getting involved in sports in unprecedented numbers, unimaginable numbers, in not just as athletes, but as coaches, administrators, journalists, spectators, in a way that changed the culture as well. So my thesis is that by the end of the 70s, you could begin to see the broad contour of what sports looks like today. And that if it wasn't for these number of events happening in the 70s, that would have taken much longer and the landscape today would be much different. Sorry, yeah. You ask a question, you get a plot.
No, and that's super helpful to kind of better understand your thought process here. Because I guess my next question, Michael, kind of goes off that. Like, you just named a ton of monumental things that changed either sports in America or how we view sports, or again, women's sports. The whole time I read the section around kind of women's basketball coming to be, all I could think of is I was like, my mom was like a teenager during all of this. And in my life, I mean, when I was growing up in the 90s, like women's college basketball was huge. Like Pat Summitt, like that was a huge deal. I couldn't even fathom 20 years earlier that did not exist.
Right.
And that really like stuck with me. And I just got to, you know, one of your Easter eggs in there, I don't know if you did it on purpose, but when it was like the biggest, like, oh, like you're talking about the 1976 women's Olympic team that won silver. And you're talking about this Pat Head in there, and then it's Pat Summitt. And I almost died. And you even mentioned it was the Tennessee coach. I should have known this, but I didn't put it together. I was like, oh. But I guess when you were looking at, again, tackling this decade, you just mentioned all these things happened. Some things you focused on more than others, even though some things were huge, but you could only, you know, talk about a little bit, others bigger. How did you decide where you're kind of dedicating chapters or more focus to, and what could be more of a footnote? Was it more personal favorites? Was it strictly what you felt like was the most impactful? Like, I'm sure you had all these notes at the start. Did you just kind of find your way along the way, or did you go with a set target of like, I need to focus a lot on this, on this, on this?
Oh, the set target never works because if you're doing research like this, I probably did 300 hours of interviews, and I mean the book took me 2.5 years. So whatever you think the book is about to start with, by the time you do all these interviews and talk to people and realize you need to talk to other people and learn these other things, by the time you actually start writing, the story has taken on a different shape. So for me, I knew about the rise of the NFL. I'd written a modern history of the NFL like 20 years ago, America's Game. I knew a good deal about the baseball and basketball and hockey pieces of the story. I remembered a bit about the tennis and the boxing. The growth of women's sports, I think, was the topic I knew the least about. And so I tried to do a lot of interviews in that area to make sure I was telling that part of the story accurately. Now, there have been plenty of good books, plenty of excellent books about Title IX. But what I was trying to do in this book is put the rise in women's sports in the context of the larger American sports scene. And so, to get back to the original question, the way I tried to organize this book is sort of the series of interweaved narratives. One having to do with the growth of sports on TV, one having to do with the emancipation of athletes, one having to do with the growth of integration in sports, one having to do with the rise of women's sports, and try to find a way to tie these together. Because of that, that dictated some of the things that I could spend more time on, less time on. I mean, everybody was around in the 70s remembers Secretariat winning the Triple Crown. And that was huge news at the time, and I mentioned it. But it didn't really fit into any of those four narrative threads. And so, other than saying there was a lot of interest in Secretariat in the summer of 73, I'll be the first to admit that somebody else who'd come to this from a different perspective might have built a narrative focused on other people. But for me, Billie Jean King, Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, Julius Erving, Jack Nicklaus, Muhammad Ali, these people were the key figures in sports. And in trying to tell those stories and try to find something new, some different perspectives on these well-known stories, because a lot's been written about, of course, the Battle of the Sexes. A lot's been written about the Ali Frazier trilogy of fights. I was trying to find a way to fit that into the larger narrative and also tell some people things about that that they may not have known.
So I'm glad you're playing into my questions very well here. This is always great when the
Doing
interviews
my
go like
best, Jim.
this. So you just named off kind of some of the key figures that you discussed. Again, the Battle of the Sexes, Muhammad Ali, Rumble in the Jungle, Thriller in Manila, Hank Aaron's 715th home run. This might be an impossible question for you, but I'm gonna ask anyway because it's my podcast and I can kind of do whatever I want on this. If I made you pick one event out of everything you cover in the book. It could be the free agency, the NBA, ABA merger, anything you want. One event though, and you're like, this was the most important event of the 1970s, the sporting event, the most. Which one would you pick?
The one that had the greatest sense of anticipation, I think, was the first Ali Frazier fight. They both got $2.5 million for that fight, which I think was a wake-up call to the true value of athletes, that they weren't just athletes, they were also entertainers. In the same way that, Paul Newman or Robert Redford could open a movie, Muhammad Ali and Joe Frazier in their first fight could get people to show up by the tens of thousands in closed circuit arenas all over the country. So that was the most anticipated. I think the most important event in the decade in sports, oddly enough, was the gimmicky Battle of the Sexes. Because coming when it did, in the aftermath of the Equal Rights Amendment and sort of the rise of second wave feminism and Roe versus Wade, there was this really pronounced pushback against women asking for equal pay, equal rights, equal opportunity. And Bobby Riggs was kind of the most obvious male chauvinist pig in the world of sports. And it wasn't like, I am not denigrating the man. That's what he claimed to be. He was a proud male chauvinist pig who said that women belonged in the bedroom and the kitchen in that order, and that they didn't have the will or the character to succeed as athletes, and they would always crack under the pressure. So after Bobby Riggs beats Margaret Court on Mother's Day in 73, Billie Jean King is just flying back from Japan. They've got a layover in Hawaii. She's trying to find out how the Riggs Court match turns out. She sees that Riggs destroys Court like 6-1, 6-2. And Billie Jean says, oh shit, now I've got to play him. She had been avoiding Riggs for years, but she realized that until somebody beat him, he was going to keep nattering on about how unequipped women were. So I think the case can be made that no athlete ever went into a match under more pressure than Billie Jean King did that night in Houston, September 20, 1973. She knew for all of her accomplishments, if she lost that match, not only was no one going to remember all of her Grand Slam titles, it was going to be used as this sort of Spanish Civil War, if you will, about the validity of female as athletes. And all across the nation, women who were involved in sports talk about that event as just groundbreaking, because that, you know, as gimmicky as it was, as silly as it was, and coming on the court with Bobby Riggs and all his bosom buddies, these women in short skirts and tight t-shirts, and Billie Jean being carried on the court in this rickshaw type device, for all of that silliness, for all that made for TV stuff, there was actually a sports event there in the middle of it. And it changed the way people thought about women athletes. So I think that was the most important.
Okay. And this could be the same answer, Michael, it could be something completely different, but if I let you time travel today back to the 70s, and you could go back and watch one, you know, one of these events, and it could just be like, I want to watch Dr. J play a game. But if you could go back in time and see any of these events live that you talk about in the book, or just any sporting event live in the 70s that you would want to today, where would you want to go back in time? What would you want to be watching, and why?
Well, it wouldn't be the Battle of the Sexes, because I watched that at the time. I remember
you watched it at the time.
Yeah. I think it would have to be, you know, I make the case in the book that Julius Erving was the last truly mythic figure in American sports, because he became a superstar without being widely seen.
Yep.
If I was playing basketball on the playgrounds in Kansas City in the mid 70s, and you'd ask 10 people who their favorite basketball player was, probably half of them would say Julius Erving. And the amazing thing about that was none of us had seen him play. ABA didn't have a national TV contract. So Julius Erving was this urban myth. You would see him on the cover of Sports Illustrated. You would see the pictures on the basketball cards of the wonderful afro and the Stars and Stripes Nets jersey. And you would hear these stories. He dunked from the free throw line. He dunked from the three-point circle. He jumped over Artis Gilmore and dunked from the half-court line. You know, that couldn't possibly be true. But there was that sense that Erving was this amazing character, and you just heard stories. When I was growing up, I thought Nassau Coliseum on Long Island was like the most exotic place ever. But I went out there in the early 2000s and passed by it on my way to do some interviews at the Jets training camp. And it's just, you know, it's this humble little arena. But it sounded exotic in the 70s when it was unseen. So, yeah, I would have loved to see Julius Erving play for the Nets, because everybody I've talked to from the ABA years said, as great as he was in the NBA, he was even better in the ABA days.
Yeah, it's almost one of those last kind of Paul Bunyan people where there's not too much film of, again, his peak. And again, he gets the NBA, he wins an MVP, wins a championship. Right. But when he was really flying out of the gym, it'd almost be like if we didn't see really Michael Jordan play until like 89, but we missed 84 through 88 when he was at his peak athleticism.
Exactly.
So I've heard that all the time. And the ABA stuff in general, just it's a shame there's not more documentation there, because there's some really fun players that by the time that I got to the NBA, they weren't exactly where they were in the NBA. And again, the free flow of that game too is just a lot different than the NBA. So, Michael, something I do on my podcast a lot with my guests, so I'm going to do it with you too, because I think the setup here is perfect. I get very fixated, and my people that follow me on Twitter know this as well, with Rushmores, right? Like building a Rushmore, the four best players of the 80s or the 90s or top four starting pitchers of all time. I was talking about Bob Gibson yesterday. Should he be on pitcher Rushmore? Mm-hmm. Your book's about the 1970s. You talk about a ton of different sports, and you got players like Hank Aaron, Kareem, Jack Nicholson, Billie Jean, all these greats. If I made you, let's say North Dakota's like, we're bummed out. Everyone pays attention to South Dakota. No one comes to North Dakota. We want to build a Rushmore representing 1970s sports. So it's only representing, it doesn't have to be the best players from the 1970s. But if I asked you, you commissioned you, Michael, tell me which four faces should we be putting on that 1970s sports Rushmore? Who would you put on there?
Well, it basically would have to be the cover of the book. So it's Billie Jean King.
Okay.
It's Muhammad Ali.
Okay. Two more.
You know, it's hard with football because the 70s was a time dominated by the Steelers. So you could argue someone like Terry Bradshaw or Franco Harris, but in my mind, Joe Green was the heart of those 70s Steelers teams. And then either Jabbar or Irving, or maybe even Jabbar and Irving, and you'd leave the NFL player off. I think Kareem Abdul-Jabbar has such an interesting story. I want to say he was the most misunderstood athlete of the 70s. Dominant athlete, consistently excellent, and yet his faith prevented a lot of people from fully appreciating him. And it also put Jabbar in this impossible position, because the average American sports fan, I think, conflated Kareem Abdul-Jabbar's very studied, comprehensive faith in Islam with Muhammad Ali's following of the Black Muslims.
Mm-hmm.
This was particularly difficult for Jabbar because while he admired Ali, he thought that Elijah Muhammad was a fraud. And, you know, this obviously culminated in the very ugly and tragic scene in which some of Ali's friends and family from the sect that in Islam that he followed were slaughtered in Washington, D.C. And it was clear that that hit was put out by the Nation of Islam. And so you had this sense all through the 70s of Jabbar dealing with all these different forces. And Jabbar would be the first to say that as difficult as it was for him, it was easier for him to be accepted changing his name because of what Muhammad Ali had done nearly a decade earlier. And so all of these things work together. And I think because of that, Jabbar was never fully appreciated in his time. It took him being the old man on the Lakers and succeeding well into his 30s before people really started to appreciate him. But, you know, has there ever been a more unblockable shot in the history of the sport than Kareem Abdul-Jabbar's sky hook? There was no answer to it. So I would put Jabbar and maybe Irving on the Rushmore as well. It's a good question, and there are no right answers. So excellent, impossible question there, Jim. Thank you.
No, and it's super tough, but I also think it shows, and this is why I think you're like, you know, when I talk about sports, and I'm very guilty of this, but I talk about, honestly, I really only talk about football, baseball, and basketball. I don't know much about hockey. I did not grow up with hockey. Even though the Blackhawks here had a really good run, I'm just not a hockey guy. So baseball, mm-hmm. basketball, football are my things. But when you're building this Rushmore in the 70s, you have these all-time greats in sports outside of those big three, those big four. Like your first two instantly were a boxer and a tennis player. And that's just not where I gravitate to. So when those positions, and they should, be taken by those two athletes, now you're stuck with two more spots and you can't even maybe put a football player on there. You can't put a baseball. So it just and then you don't even talk about Jack Nicholson. Like, he could easily be thrown on there as well. So Jack Nicklaus, Golden Bear. So also, I real quick on him, I had no idea. And again, I'm going to wave the flag of I was really a 90s kid, but you talk early on about Jack and how he was a little chubby at first.
Fat
and
Jack.
I never heard that in my life. I always thought of him as this like good looking guy, this fit guy. So that blew my mind. I had to go back and look and be like, is this right? Like, I've never heard this. Fat Jack, never heard that. But so many great athletes in the 70s. And I knew that was going to be a super tough question. I figured Muhammad Ali and Billie Jean had to be on there, but I was super curious on who your last two are, and I like them. Final question for you, Michael, before we get you out of here. Again, I enjoyed this book so much on a decade that I was not alive for. I have no idea what your future holds and what your next book may be. If you ever were to write another book like this about another decade, which decade do you think would be either the best decade to pick in terms of there's the most to cover or just the most enjoyable for you to write if you were to cover another decade? What would it be and why?
If I ever try to write about another decade, I just need to go out back and hang myself or something. This is just... in terms of fascinating decades, though, you know, I have to say the decade we are in right now is also going to be transformational. I mean, what we are seeing in the 2020s with the rise of analytics, with the rise of fans having access to the NFL's All 22, you could draw a direct line. I mentioned near the end of my book what Bill James brought to the table as the father of sabermetrics, with changing the way baseball was scouted, eventually the way baseball was played. You could draw a line to that, to where we are today with heightened awareness of spin rate and launch velocity, all of those minute things. Bill James was the first to turn those standard statistics and try to find out more and understand the game better. And so I would submit to you that the average fan in 2023 understands the game so much better than fans did 50 years ago. I mean, you look back at some of the things people said, you know, like Jack Morris, he pitches to the score, which doesn't really make any sense when you look at it. Or, you know, Fran Tarkenton, he adds three wins a game because of his scrambling ability. Well, it's harder to quantify football because it's more interdependent and more fluid than it is baseball. But I think that a lot of those assumptions don't stand up to scrutiny, and now they do. And so as we go through the season, people understand, you know, the Kansas City Chiefs, who have the best quarterback in the world and have won two of the last four Super Bowls, right now, the average fan knows Chiefs are having trouble in third and short because Andy Reid won't sneak Patrick Mahomes. That sort of minute understanding of these factors that influence a game didn't really exist at that pervasive level 50 years ago. And so as we learn more and more about it, the challenge is to retain a sense of wonder for when you see something that's truly amazing. And we still have it when you know, Victor Wembanyama comes out from into the paint and blocks a three-point shot. You don't see that every day. These certain plays when Myles Garrett jumps over an entire offensive line to block a field goal attempt, those are things we don't see every day. But we are in this era of complete information saturation, and that is a fascinating time to be a sports fan.
I like that answer a lot. And, you know, the decade just started. So maybe in 7 years, Michael, when you're a little farther away from writing this book, you're going to feel better about writing a 2020s Transform Sports in America book. But Michael, really enjoyed having you on. Really fun conversation. And again, getting like your book, was a fun time. So thank you for writing it, even though it sounds like it might have been painstaking. But I know writing any book is all any author I've ever spoken to. That is how they explain the writing process. Before I get you out of here, Michael, anything else you want to plug outside of your latest book?
No, I think the latest book is it. It's available anywhere you find books. I'm glad to hear that somebody who didn't live through the 70s enjoyed it, because I didn't want it to get pigeonholed as just a gift you get your dad. I think that anybody who loves sports can find something they enjoy in this book. And so, yeah, the book is available Amazon, bookshop.com, Barnes and Noble, and people who want signed copies can go to my website at michaelmccambridge.com.
So once again, that's The Big Time, How the 1970s Transformed Sports in America. Michael, thank you so much for coming on. Looking forward to see what you're going to write next. And hopefully we can find a way to get you back on this podcast one day.
Sounds good. Thanks so much, Jim.
All right. I want to thank Michael again for coming on the podcast today. Really enjoyed talking to him about his latest book. Again, that book is The Big Time, How the 1970s Transformed Sports in America. You can find this anywhere you buy books, whether it be online or the bookstore. I put it at bookstores the last couple of weeks. I've seen it on the bookshelves, online, again, Amazon, wherever you want to go. It is there. Go pick it up if you are running out of ideas for your loved ones for the holidays. But that is, again, all we have for you today. If you don't already, please follow us on Apple Podcasts or Spotify, where you listen to podcasts. Follow us on Twitter at Pod of Fame. If you have done all of that, you have done your homework. We will have a baseball episode for you next Monday. We will have Hall of Fame Market Watch this Friday. So I hope you all have a great week, and we will talk to you soon. Take care.